want to be crystal clear, absolutely accountable, and within the letter of the law.
Lawmakers will have to submit expenses for their office accounts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a successful science collaboration between the Village of Chivac and federal biologists.
There's five times as many cackling geese as there used to be, and white-fronted goose numbers were down, or there's too many of them now. They're trying to figure out how to get rid of them, basically.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com.
For the past year, legislators have been required to treat their office accounts as income. They got a lump sum from the state and were expected to spend that money on stationery and mailers under the honor system. Now they're moving back to a policy where they have to submit receipts for those expenditures. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
There were a few big problems with the old system. For one, the public couldn't track how legislators were spending their office money. But voters could be sure that not all of it was going to newsletters and pens. Since the money was treated as income, at least part of it went into lawmakers' retirement funds. An even larger chunk went to the federal government in the form of income taxes, as Representative Peggy Wilson pointed out at a legislative council meeting on Thursday.
So much is taken out for taxes, and so you don't have as much. It's not the full amount by a long shot.
And if any legislator did have money left over, there wasn't a mechanism for them to give it back to the state. It was kept as their income. For all these reasons, the Legislative Council, which sets office policy for the Capitol, revisited how to handle these funds. Each lawmaker gets up to $20,000 for their office annually, and it adds up to more than $1 million in discretionary funds for the whole legislature. Most lawmakers at the meeting supported switching to a system where they have to apply for reimbursements. That way, their office accounts wouldn't be taxed, wouldn't end up in their own pockets, and would go back to the state. But there was discussion of how that system could inconvenience people who represent rural districts, where costs are higher and receipts aren't always available. Senator Donnie Olson, a Bush Democrat who represents the state's largest district, said he prefers administering the account on his own.
It causes me somewhat of an undue hardship because I've got to go ahead and start putting all these receipts together, send them on in, and because of my remote location, there's a time for reimbursement and my credit card starts to accumulate up toward the amount of the limit.
Mike Hawker, an Anchorage Republican who chairs the council, responded that if the legislature were a corporation, it would be appropriate for people to manage their own office funds. But since they were dealing with public money, reimbursements made more sense.
I want to be crystal clear, absolutely accountable, and within the letter of the law.
The motion ended up passing unanimously. A group of mostly Democratic lawmakers had filed bills to switch to a reimbursement system earlier this year, but their legislation was never heard. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The legal fight over Alaska's redistricting plan may be nearing an end. Jason Gazewood, an attorney for Fairbanks area plaintiffs George Riley and Ronald Dearborn, says they do not plan to appeal a decision approving the latest map. A spokesman says Alaska's Democratic Party also does not plan to appeal. Gazewood says those who filed friend of court briefs may have standing to appeal, but he didn't think so. On Monday, Superior Court Judge Michael McConaughey ruled the plan met constitutional challenges. The decision was the latest in a dispute that dates to 2011 and has involved several proposed iterations for Alaska's political boundaries. The Alaska Supreme Court allowed an interim map to be used for last year's elections, but in December ordered the redistricting board to redraw the map. With maps more firmed up, a couple of political challengers have submitted paperwork to the Division of Elections. Harry Crawford, a former state legislator from Anchorage, filed a letter of intent yesterday, but says he is still deciding whether to run for House or Senate. And today, Mat-Su Borough Assemblyman Jim Culver announced that he plans to run against Representative Eric Feige in the Republican primary for their district. A construction project in McGrath last year uncovered three skeletons. Authorities opened a missing persons case, but it turns out these remains have been missing for much longer than anyone expected. Radiocarbon dating shows the bones could be 1,000 years old. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, scientists have spent the last year analyzing DNA and isotopes to find out more about who the individuals were, what they ate, and whether they are related to people living in the McGrath area today.
It's been a year since Tanana Chiefs Conference senior archaeologist Bob Sattler announced the remains of three people discovered in McGrath in 2012 are between 800 and 1,000 years old.
We have an opportunity for the first time, I think, in Alaska to look at three generations of the biological, you know, evidence or signatures in those individuals to determine their possibly their migration patterns, their diet, and so forth.
The remains known as the Tauchuk McGrath discovery are those of two adult men and a child. It's not yet clear whether the child was male or female, but scientists do know how old the individuals were when they died.
The older adult guy is somewhere in the range of 35 to 40 years old. The younger man is somewhere in the range of 19 to 20 years old, and the child is 2 to 3 years old.
All three skeletons were found together, buried by layers of ancient river sediment. Jeff Hayes is a population geneticist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. He's analyzing DNA from the bones.
You know, the interior of Alaska is a really large area, and we know next to nothing about the genetics of the people that live there, either now or in the past. So I think this is a really exciting start to try and pursue that and learn more about it.
All humans inherit genetic information from both of their parents. Hayes' analysis shows the two older men share a patriline, meaning the genetic information they would have inherited from their father is the same.
But we don't know how closely related they are. They could just as easily, based off the data that we have so far, be distantly related cousins as they are father, son, or uncle, nephew.
Hayes says deeper genetic analysis is difficult because the remains are so old. But there are other stories to be told. Hayes is working with TCC, as well as the tribal government in McGrath, to find living relatives. He may also be able to look at linkages between ancient and modern health and disease.
So, for example, we have a really good idea of the particular genetic markers that are associated with, say, obesity or type 2 diabetes. And with collaboration of other investigators who do the genetics of prehistoric populations. You know, we could be looking for similarities and differences in the frequency of particular genetic risk factors in the individuals that lived several hundred years ago and those that live in the region today.
The remains also shed a little light on how people lived along the Kuskokwim River in the past. Scientists have long believed ancient Alaska Native diets were rich in fish, but archaeologists rarely find fish bones at ancient campsites. An isotopic analysis of the Tauchuk McGrath remains shows the men relied heavily on fish as part of their diet. Karin Hoffman is an anthropologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She was surprised to find that even the child was eating fish.
The child has a nitrogen isotope signal that suggests it had been weaned and had been weaned for a long time, at least a year. Now, at first, that might not seem unusual to you. It was 2 to 3 years old, and that would be a rather late time today for weaning. But in the past, people nursed children for a much longer time.
A team was in McGrath this summer to excavate more of the site. TCC has a memorandum of understanding with the McGrath Native Village Council and MTNT Limited, a Native corporation that serves four villages in the region. The research agreement is for 5 years. When the studies are complete, the remains will be returned for a traditional reburial ceremony. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, bowling for charity with a turkey.
There are all kinds of creative ways that they're having fun while giving at the same time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The family of a man fatally shot by Anchorage police is suing the police department, officers, and the city, claiming reckless, excessive force was used. Anchorage attorney Philip Widener is representing the family of Shane Tazzi, who was fatally shot in June of 2012. Widener says the lawsuit filed Thursday seeks more than $1 million. Police say Officer Boaz Guyanson fired at Tazzi after Tazzi approached him aggressively with a stick and refused repeated commands to put it down. According to police, an investigation determined Guyanson used justifiable force when he drew his service weapon and shot the 26-year-old man. Police say a toxicology report showed Tazzi had a blood alcohol level of 0.185, more than twice the legal driving limit. The U.S. Senate this week has been debating how the military should handle sexual assault reports from service members. Both Alaska senators have signed on to an amendment that would let military prosecutors, rather than a suspect's commander, determine which cases to pursue. Senator Lisa Murkowski yesterday spoke on the Senate floor about some of the incidents that motivate her. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Murkowski has been speaking out for weeks on the need to change military culture, which she says is inclined to sweep serious charges under the rug rather than protect victims. When she was in Anchorage Town Square for an Olympic send-off this month, Murkowski says a woman ran out from a nearby building in the cold with no coat to urge her to keep pressing for change.
She wanted to make sure that I knew that she too had been a victim, but that she had not had the strength to report.
Murkowski says the woman told her the crime caused her to abandon her own military career while the perpetrator stayed.
And as he stayed on, he continued to be promoted. And her plea to me was, please don't let that continue.
And Murkowski says she learned last spring that a young woman she had nominated to one of the military academies, a woman whose success she'd been following, had been sexually assaulted at the academy. Murkowski says the woman did graduate and become an officer.
But now the burden of dealing with the fact that she was not protected from the crime has caused her to resign her commission. So she put 4 years of very hard work, really very hard work, toward a military career, and that's in the garbage.
The Senate adjourned for Thanksgiving break today without voting on the military sexual assault measure or the defense bill. Opponents of the measure say removing the chain of command from the decision-making would weaken commanders and leave them less able to impose discipline. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Going into 2014, the Anchorage School District faces more budget cuts. The gap is big, $21 million, caused by 4 years of flat funding from the governor combined with general cost of living increases. The school board recently held three community meetings to gauge what residents value as the district approaches the next round of cuts. KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports.
At the community meetings, participants heard an overview of the budget situation for the district. Then they answered multiple choice questions with a clicker. They also broke into small groups for discussion, kind of like a focus group. The meetings were held at schools over 3 days in November. They were open to the public, and more than 360 people turned out. Shanna Zespan with Agnew Beck Consulting, one of the firms hired to conduct the research, recently briefed the Anchorage School Board on highlights of the meetings. During the meetings, participants were asked to rank programs by importance. Zespan.
The top point getters were really science, social studies, career technical, and reading and writing. And then in that same conversation, there was a discussion about class size and participants were asked to decide whether that was important to education, and 81% of participants combined thought it was either very important or important.
The next set of questions was about staffing levels and where to make cuts. 45% of participants wanted to see cuts made to district-wide support services, then building and ancillary support services, and building leadership support. Instructional support and classroom instruction came last. Zuspan says the majority of participants preferred isolating the budget cuts to specific areas rather than across the board. But they also said this.
In the small groups or in the report out sessions, people did mention that, you know, isolating cuts to really popular programs would be an effective tool to engage more people in the community and kind of get them riled up and participating more.
Participants also discussed how cost-cutting could impact sports and student activities.
One of the questions that was asked was, how important is student athletics to your educational experience? And combined, I think it's like 81% thought it was very important or important. And then there was a series of questions about getting at more of, you know, how that should be paid for.
Zuspan says they asked participants what portion of the cost of participation in sports that students and their families should be responsible for. 10% of respondents said players and families shouldn't pay anything, while 16% said 100% of the cost should be paid by players and families. The district will incorporate suggestions from the community conversations into the budget development process. The district also has an online suggestion box on their website. Superintendent Ed Graff will present a balanced budget proposal to the Anchorage School Board in February. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
In Alaska, fishermen and scientists have a long history of working together to figure out how to catch fish in a way that's safe for crew members and for the species in the ocean. Now there's a plethora of research groups out there wanting to set up those partnerships, but as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, it's getting harder to organize their efforts.
Craig Rose works for the Alaska Fisheries Science Center, and for the past decade, a lot of his effort has gone into the Bering Sea pollock fleet. Rose works on gear modifications to cut down on bycatch, and one of his big projects has been salmon excluders, which keep pollock in a trawl net and skip over Chinook and Chum salmon. Rose says that for work like that,
you know, you need to bring the people in that know the gear and know the fish in early, so you can work with something that is going to actually apply to the fishery.
The pollock fleet helped Rose test drive excluder nets in tanks and out at sea over and over until they found one that worked. It's a prime example of something called cooperative research.
Fisheries agencies and the fishing industry work together to solve problems, to collect information.
In theory, it's an ideal partnership, but Rose says some of these research projects are running into roadblocks.
There is a shortage of funding, and it's scattered. You know, in terms of the ability to coordinate and bring things together, that structure is not there.
Right now, industry trade groups are funneling money into research boards. There are more than a dozen of them out there just operating in the North Pacific and Bering Sea. It's up to those boards to find scientists who want to work with the commercial fishing fleet on a research project, and it's up to the boards to help the commercial vessels get the right government permits to allow them to participate. John Govan has set up plenty of these research partnerships. He says it can take a few years to get the projects off the ground, and once they start, the teams can get laser-focused on their subject, like incidental catch in the pollock fishery.
We might want to think about what you'd learn about fish behavior between pollock and those species at the same time, but you're out there going, well, we're working on salmon bycatch.
Govan says it doesn't have to be like that.
There's the ways to get more out of your research dollar if you can have a planning process and a systematic approach.
In a presentation at the Pacific Marine Expo in Seattle this week, Govan made a case for getting the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration involved. NOAA's used congressional line item money to set up regional offices for overseeing this kind of research. There's one in the southeast and one in the northeast United States. In his presentation, Govan says Alaska needs one too, but Govan says he's really open to anything that would get research better organized.
You know, it's not necessarily a government program. It might be some amalgam of industry and government and universities, but it would be something that brings the parties together in a way that we haven't been able to do in these sort of ad hoc individual efforts.
Jim Rule is an East Coast fisherman born and bred, and he says Alaska shouldn't back off the idea of getting the government involved so easily. With NOAA's regional boards in place, Rule says East Coast fishery management councils were able to set up a reliable source of funding for cooperative research. The source? Seafood itself.
In other words, the management council has the ability to set aside a portion of that, up to 3% of the stock. And that stock is converted to dollars through an auction process where the fish are sold back to the fishery.
Rule says it's not a perfect system, but since 2008, it's paid for him to fish with scientists aboard his 90-foot trawler, the Derrina R. Rule and the crew do two trawls a year from Cape Hatteras, North Carolina to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, gathering data for multiple fishery stock assessments. Now that they finally have enough data, their finds are making their way to fisheries managers. Rule says he hopes more fishermen will follow his example on the East Coast and in Alaska.
It's foolish not to be involved, you know, because when you're on the ocean, when you're fishing, you experience change, you adapt to change. By being involved with cooperative research, now you adapt to that change and improve it scientifically to where other people can benefit.
It's just a matter of making sure those people know how to get started. Reporting in Seattle, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A new book celebrates 25 years of collaborative research and science between the Chupik people of Chivek, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the U.S. Geological Survey. The title, Banding Together to Learn and Preserve, 25 Years of Goose Banding at Old Chivek, lays out the premise of this yearbook-style collection of pictures and science information gathered during the decades of bird banding. The work was prompted by declines in cackling, white-front emperor, and black-brant geese. USGS wildlife biologist Craig Ely got young people from Chivek involved to herd the geese. He says it helped alleviate mistrust by locals about what the feds were doing and whether it was harming the geese.
So once you get to know them, then you're going to believe a little bit more what they say. So that when we tell them, that it doesn't bother the birds, they're more likely to believe it if they trust us as individuals. So that was a real big benefit of the project as well.
Chivek elder Leo Moses worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on banding projects for many years along the banks of the Kashunut River. The nearly 81-year-old teaches Chupik culture at the Chivek High School. He says traditionally people herded the geese into nets and caught them to butcher and dry. He showed the biologists how to use the method to catch the birds for banding.
We learned to work together, that which is good. And when the children started going herd and band them, and learn to sex the birds and stuff, well, that's educational.
Moses traveled from Chivek with James Ayulik, who also teaches at the school and is the chief of the traditional council. Ayulik remembers hunting the geese when he was younger, rounding them up and catching them in nets. It meant survival for Chupik people generations ago to be able to harvest the geese. Now, Ayulik says, the harvest is restricted, but there's new food in the area.
Like moose, 50 years ago wasn't there. Beaver, 30 years ago wasn't there. But we do catch geese, yes, we do. We continue it. I try not to catch them as much. I want my grandchildren someday to appreciate them as well. So one dinner a month, that's good enough. I have beaver meat over here. There's moose meat over there. Other sources. If I want modern food, I'll go store, maybe have a burger or pizza.
USGS biologist Ely says an early 80s accord between local native people and state and federal agencies resulted in the Yukon Delta Management Plan that he says was one of the first major agreements between indigenous people and agencies to manage through limited harvest. He says the results are clear.
There's five times as many cackling geese as there used to be, and white-fronted goose numbers were down, or there's too many of them now. They're trying to figure out how to get rid of them, basically. Emperor geese and black brant, we banded those also. They haven't done quite as well, but they're still improving.
A copy of the book will be presented to all households in Chivac. Links to the book and pictures are at our website, alaskapublic.org. That's not a rowdy bowling alley, but lunch hour yesterday at Juneau's State Office Building. KTOO's Jeremy Shea brings us this story about an unusual fundraiser.
The unmistakable sound of bowling pins getting knocked around echoes up several stories of the State Office Building. One makeshift bowling lane with 10 real pins has been fashioned out of duct tape and a plastic drop cloth on the tile floor. A handful of state workers are bowling with an 8-pound frozen turkey. Here's Bong Karandang in the midst of a competitive game.
Well, I had 34 right now on the fourth frame, but the last two frames I'll get a strike. I'm going to try and get a strike.
The turkey hucking is a spectacle. Folks are watching in the atrium and several more gawk from interior office windows. The event was organized by employees of the Division of Enterprise Technology Services. They charge $2 a throw or $5 for a 6-frame game. It's a fundraiser for the state's SHARE campaign.
The SHARE campaign is Alaska State Employees Charitable Giving Program.
That's Paula Pulowski. She's the SHARE campaign coordinator for the whole state, though her day job is as executive director of Serve Alaska. Different offices run the SHARE campaign from year to year.
Turkey bowling, I was very envious of. It sounded like great fun.
It's one of many novel events state employees across Alaska put together to raise money for charities and nonprofits. Past events included selling chances to throw a pie at IT people, Halloween parties, coffee sales, silent auctions, chili cook-offs, and bake sales.
There are all kinds of creative ways that they're having fun while giving at the same time.
The SHARE campaign goal for the year is to raise $415,000. The campaign's about two-thirds of the way there. Wednesday's turkey bowling event will kick in another $95, less the cost of the drop cloth. Taku Lane's donated the pins. The two turkeys used were also donated, but were too beat up to be re-gifted. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Daisy Eaton in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Seattle, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alex Hotel and Suites, featuring 122 guest rooms with amenities that include a 24-hour airport shuttle and Wi-Fi. Information on Alaska resident rates at 1-800-221-7550. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.